Well, after another night and morning in the single digits here in Lansing, I'm trying to remember why I used to look forward to March. There was a time when I actually looked forward to March. I always anticipate the month because it usually clears 50 or 55 degrees, maybe once, sometimes more. Heck, 2 years ago we cleared 80 a few times. I'm sure you remember that. But this year, at least, we cannot seem to turn the corner on midwinter weather, although apparently some relief is on the way. Above freezing high temperatures tomorrow, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. A ray of hope if you're over the intense winter, as I imagine you are. Later this hour on Current State, meet the new CEO of East Lansing's Prima Civitas. That, of course, is the MSU-created nonprofit whose job is to spur economic and community development around our state. Also, the history of the now-extinct passenger pigeon in Michigan. Until yesterday, all I knew about the passenger pigeon was that it was extinct. That was really about the long and the short of it. Author Bill Loomis of Ann Arbor shares the story of what happened to this bird, millions and millions of which were in Michigan, say, 150 years ago or so. So if all you know about the passenger pigeon is that, oh yeah, that's the bird that went extinct along with the dodo, there's so much more to the story, and Bill Loomis tells that story so well. He joins us later this hour on Current State. At the top of our program, the Michigan Supreme Court will hear arguments this morning on what should be done with more than 350 prison inmates sentenced to life with no chance of parole, and they were sentenced as juveniles. The Michigan case follows a U.S. Supreme Court decision from 2012 declaring life without parole sentences for minors violate the U.S. Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. To bring us up to speed on what's happening here in Lansing, we welcome Rick Pluta, the Michigan Public Radio Network's top dog at state capitol. Hi, Rick.
Hello, Mark.
First of all, give us a brief history of this issue leading up to today. This really goes back to the U.S. Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, and in the case of Miller versus Alabama, the United States Supreme Court ruled, as you said, that for juveniles who have sort of a unique space in the criminal justice system, it is cruel and unusual punishment to automatically send them to life with no chance of parole. The idea is that children are different. They think differently. They're motivated differently. And at a young age, that the chances of rehabilitation are considered greater. And so the court said that if you are going to try to send a juvenile to life without parole, and in Michigan, and with its adult time for adult crime laws, that would be for first-degree murder, you at least have to have a sentencing hearing that takes into account their circumstances. Were they victims of some type of abuse or neglect at home? How culpable were they? That we have situations where juveniles who were accessories, and you can be convicted of first-degree murder as an accessory, who nevertheless got stiffer punishments, life without parole, than the people who actually committed the killing, wielded the weapon that took the life.
Yeah.
And that's because children and adults just, you know, basically they problem solve differently, to put it in clinical terms. And so that's why the court said we had to do that. As a matter of fact, there was a Michigan case that was on a parallel track that also was challenging the Michigan lifer law as cruel and unusual punishment. And that got put on hold because of the Miller decision. And now that judge is basically just kind of overseeing how well Michigan is complying with that. Now, on a separate track in the state courts, there is this case. It's three juvenile lifers, but it is a class action lawsuit, so it would affect all of the juvenile lifers in the system, who say that this Miller decision, the state is applying it to current cases, and it will apply it in future cases, as the Supreme Court called for. But since we're dealing with a constitutional right, it also should be applied retroactively, and that they deserve resentencing hearings that take into account their circumstances, their histories, their culpability. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're in court about today. The state attorney general, Bill Schuette, is there saying, no, this is not actually about what's called a – it's not a substantive decision. It's very technical legal. This is not a substantive decision that basically created a new legal right for people who are currently serving, but it's a process decision. It doesn't make a difference as to whether they were guilty or innocent, that they would have been found guilty regardless of the Miller decision, regardless of the rights that were conferred by the Miller decision. And so therefore, it's a process question. And because, you know, that we need to have finality and stability in the legal system, it should not be applied retroactively. These are the arguments that are being, that will be heard in the oral arguments today. But a lot of different parties have taken an interest in this. There are 24 friend of the court briefs, amicus briefs, that have been filed on this case regarding retroactivity and resentencing hearings for juvenile lifers.
You've captured pretty well what inmates advocates are saying, it's a very emotional issue for people.
Absolutely.
on both sides. Tell us more about what victims' advocates are saying.
Well, I mean, it's the sort of the survivor network, the people who are left behind after someone is murdered, is somewhat divided on this. There are people who are saying that you know, we want the capacity and forgive and move on, but there are people who are saying, you know what, This was finalized for us. We were told life without parole. They're, you know, that they're in, they're never getting out. We've closed the door, we've moved on, and now you're telling us that that we've got this court case going on right now, that we've got hearings about legislation to implement the Miller decision, and now you're telling us that we thought that this was done and over with. And now you're telling us that we're being resentenced too, to a lifetime of parole hearing notices that we've then got to go back and relive.
Yeah, so the closure that they thought they had, they may not have.
That's true. It is a sad reality that no matter what the court does, that someone is going to walk away the loser.
There are a couple of other states dealing with this issue right now, Pennsylvania and Nebraska most notably, although a federal judge here in Michigan has pushed for resentencing. Judge O'Meara, resentencing hearings here as well. Does this end up being a patchwork of rules there where some states look to resentence and others say too late?
Well, somewhat. I mean, it depends. It could conceivably wind up again at the Supreme Court to come up with some way to, bring all of these systems together. But under our system, every state does get to determine how it complies with decisions like the Miller decision. And then if there's some question as to whether or not they're doing it right, then the states get sued, usually in federal court.
But we could end up with some kind of patchwork in the
end. We will end up on the national level. We will end up with something of a patchwork.
Okay.
But they've all got to operate within the confines of what the Supreme Court said they have to do, which is, I mean, that's why we have this controversy about whether people who are currently in prison because they were sentenced to life without parole as juveniles for murder, whether or not it gets applied to them. And, other states are sorting that out as well.
We're talking with Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta about today's activity at the Michigan Supreme Court involving juvenile lifers in our state. The anti-resentencing faction, most prominently Attorney General Bill Schuette, also claims that this will cost money the state doesn't have. Does anyone know how much reconsidering 350 plus cases would cost?
No, we don't know. And it's not just the financial cost, but some of these cases, that Michigan's adult time for adult crime law was passed in the mid-1990s, but we've had juvenile lifers who were sentenced as far back as the early 1960s. And so one of the things that the state is arguing is, if you're going to have a real resentencing hearing, then you need to go back and you need to find the experts. You need to find witnesses who will talk about how these people were raised. And in some cases, it's going to demand resources that aren't just expensive, but just impossible to track down. And if you're if one of the things that you're looking for in a justice system is equal treatment under the law, that means that people who were sentenced a long time ago aren't going to get that equal treatment because it's just going to be harder to find the experts and witnesses who matter in those cases versus the more recent cases. So they're saying that, you know, in some cases it's not just expensive, it's impossible.
Okay. Very interesting stuff. Great job bringing us up to speed on this, Rick. Rick Plute is with the Michigan Public Radio Network at the Capitol. Thanks very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
We also sent current state production assistant Hannah Michaeljohn out on the town yesterday to find out what people in Lansing thought about this difficult debate. Here's what she found.
I mean, my wife happens to be a social worker, so I know some kids are brought up in horrendous situations. And if they killed somebody, that's not going to bring somebody back. But some of the stuff I know is that if they ended up killing a parent and it was because of abuse, sexual abuse or something to that effect, they're probably not going to be a repeat offender. So they probably should be able to be looking at parole.
I think they should get retried. Just so to be fair for everybody, they don't get a lot of chances like everyone else does, so I think they should retry them.
I feel like they should have a fair trial for another time. They should be allowed to, be given another chance. I mean, at least take a look at what their case was before.
Give you some input.
Is it okay? I
lost a best friend to murder, and there was a 16-year-old involved. So, like, to me, I feel he should be tried just the same as everybody else. And if he got the life sentence, he was involved. He may not have shot her, but he was there and helped with the crime. So I feel he should be tried as an adult. And if he's given the life sentence, then
so be it
at that point. Because you wanted to play big boy games, you should deserve the big boy sentence.
That was Phil Brooks, Tiffany Thomas, John Stevenson, and Shayna Clemens. Welcome back to Current State. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Since 2006, East Lansing's Prima Civitas has been a catalyst for economic and community development, initially here in mid-Michigan and eventually across the state. The nonprofit brings together business owners, entrepreneurs, and MSU resources to spark economic growth. In its 8 years, Prima Civitas has helped the city of Flint submit a balanced budget and a deficit reduction plan. It helped several Michigan municipalities update their civic regulations to streamline them and make them more functional. More recently, the 501c3s even adopted a global approach, connecting Michigan talent with global initiatives in Turkey and Iraq. Prima Civitas recently announced a new CEO. Arnold Weinfeld takes over the top spot after several years as a Prima Civitas board member, and we welcome Arnold Weinfeld to Current State.
Thank you, Mark.
Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
It's great to talk to you. What's it like transitioning from the board to the top inside position?
Well, it's been very comfortable and actually somewhat seamless. Obviously very helpful to have been on the board the last few years. And get an understanding of the work that that Prima Civitas does and the people in the organization. So I feel like moving into the CEO spot has been, as I said, somewhat seamless. It's just now digging into the projects and moving forward.
Do you want to tinker with the foundation's priorities? Do you want to refocus, realign, anything along those lines?
No, I want to enhance what they do. I think one of the reasons that I found becoming CEO attractive is because from the moment I got on the board, I was very impressed with the work that that Steve Webster, the CEO at the time, and the staff were doing. Very passionate group of people, dedicated to working on moving Michigan's economy forward. And so the buckets of work that, you know, Prima Civitas is in is, as you noted, maintaining that original mission of fostering regional economic development opportunities across the state, working in innovation and talent to help Michigan's workforce become more in tune with our 21st century economy, and in the international space as well, creating opportunities for Michigan business, Michigan State University, and other universities and community colleges across the state on an international basis.
You've spent some years with the Michigan Municipal League, and Prima Civitas has spent significant resources in Michigan urban areas. Mm-hmm. Can we assume that that'll continue to be a focus of Prima Civitas efforts?
No question about it. A focus, and it's certainly one of the areas where I see an opportunity for enhancement.
How? Can you give us an example?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you mentioned some of the work that Prima Civitas has done in the past, and we have some great staff members with a lot of experience in local government. For instance, Mike Brown.
Top of the list, I would imagine, with all of his history in
Flint. Absolutely, in Flint. And he was, you know, Mike was president of Prima Civitas going back to when David Hollister was the first CEO of Prima Civitas. And then, yeah, he was called back home to Flint and now is back on staff. We have Jim Smirtka, who's the former city attorney for Lansing and has been involved in municipal government activities for over 30 years. And, you know, along with the other projects, Prima Civitas helped design and set up the I-69 Economic Development Corridor that involves several counties and over 30 communities coming together to form an entity that now works to enhance economic development along that corridor on I-69. You mentioned the Flint project. I think that there is definitely still a need out there. Especially in our urban areas, they're facing some difficult organizational challenges, and I think we can take the expertise we have at Prima Civitas and use it to the benefit of those communities.
Now, the organization adopted a statewide orientation, mm-hmm. what you called Prima Civitas 2.0, a few years ago. After a period of limiting your focus on mid-Michigan, but what is Prima Civitas doing in mid-Michigan these days?
Yeah, great point. In mid-Michigan, we're working with Michigan State University on a project we call Gigabit Communities, where we're working to provide super high-speed internet access to attract, retain businesses and their workforces. We're hoping to roll out a pilot here in East Lansing. And Flint is also interested in bringing our expertise there. We're also working with school districts, both in mid-Michigan and outside of mid-Michigan, to encourage entrepreneurship among underserved students, as well as STEM learning opportunities, two areas that we feel are very important for Michigan to move forward with retaining and attracting talent.
What sort of international opportunities are you looking at here, though, Arnold? I know you've been involved with Turkish businesses. Mm-hmm. There was a project, a very ambitious project a couple of years ago involving building essentially a suburb or a city in Iraq that right. Prima Civitas was really at the heart of. Talk to us about the international opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. Our Turkish connection is very strong. We have a subsidiary that we developed a few years ago, the Turkish Resource Center of North America, that is staffed by someone who serves as a consul general for Turkey here in Michigan. As a matter of fact, we've just had a couple of delegations over in Turkey from Oakland University and Oakland County researching business opportunities in April. We'll be hosting the Turkish Automotive Association here at MSU in an effort to familiarize them with opportunities here in Michigan and also for Michigan-based business to become more familiar with possible automotive supplier opportunities that are in Turkey.
But clarify for us, though, how does the international scope of what you do really benefit, how does that manifest itself in Michigan businesses? This gets Michigan businesses involved in initiatives in other countries?
Yep. And
vice versa?
And vice versa. You know, one of the really neat things about Prima Civitas is what I call the three C's. Prima Civitas is a convener, a connector, and a collaborator. And, you know, we are the flexible, nimble organization Luanna Simon, President Simon, had a vision for to help move Michigan State University, mid-Michigan, and in statewide eventually, Michigan businesses with opportunities both within the state to collaborate and enhance their models and also internationally. So we've exactly that. We've been connecting Michigan businesses with opportunities in Turkey. I'm very hopeful and that this Turkish automotive piece is going to be a catalyst for further opportunities. You mentioned the Iraq project. It is still a very ambitious project. First week on the job, and I just had an opportunity this week to go to Washington, D.C., and meet with Dr. Sami Alaraji, who is the former MSU student. Here in the mid-60s, who is now in charge of investment in Iraq and has a deep fondness for Michigan State University and the people of Michigan for the experiences that he received here at the university, both at the undergrad level, and he received his doctorate here at Michigan State University. And you're exactly on point. There's a great need for housing in Iraq and in Baghdad in particular, and we are continuing to work with them on developing what is basically a city within a city. They're looking at building 70,000 housing units, a mixed-use commercial and retail area with recreational facilities and sporting facilities as well. And so at this point, we're hoping to be a part of the project. We're still working with Dr. Sami. I had the opportunity and pleasure to meet with him yesterday and talk about the project. It's about ready to move forward, and through Prima Civitas, we're going to be working to connect especially Michigan housing businesses with opportunities there and hopefully be able to get some work for Michigan businesses.
And I have to say, I did a couple of stories on this a couple of years ago, and one of the interesting manifestations of this whole thing is connecting Southeast Michigan construction businesses mm-hmm. and related businesses mm-hmm. operated by Iraqi Americans. Americans of Iraqi descent with this project.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And that continues to be our goal. So right now we're continuing to work through those processes that they have in Iraq, and we're very hopeful that we'll be able to have this come to fruition here yet this year.
Arnold Weinfeld is the incoming CEO of Prima Civitas here in East Lansing. What's the biggest challenge that you think you face as incoming CEO?
Continuing to move forward and finding opportunities for Michigan businesses and Michigan universities, both here in the state and internationally. I think that there are a lot of opportunities. We just got to go out and find them.
How does the rebound of the state economy impact what you do at Prima Civitas? Does that make your job easier?
It obviously plays a very positive role, especially as we travel outside of the state internationally. I think Governor Snyder has shown that, you know, there is opportunity here in Michigan for international companies to do business, that we have a skilled labor force, and Prima Civitas is going to be working to enhance the talent of that labor force and make connections not just for that labor force within Michigan but outside of Michigan, for Michigan businesses outside of Michigan, and vice versa.
You're involved in a partnership to start a university in Benghazi?
That project is kind of a lower priority right now. As we move forward, we're working on other projects that involve other Mideast countries right now.
It's still alive, or you've shelved
it? It's simmering, but we'll say it's simmering right now.
Okay. You've done an awful lot with young innovators. I mean, innovation is one of the words that mm-hmm. keeps cropping up right. in your mission statement. It's mm-hmm. all over your website, and you've especially tried to connect with young people with regard to innovation. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. innovation and talent kind of go hand in hand. One of our more positive projects has been the Michigan Internship Initiative, which is a project that we've had for several years working with Michigan businesses on getting on matching them up with interns. We've been working with MEDC in particular on that. One of the other projects in entrepreneurship that we've been working with, encouraging school districts to work with underserved students in entrepreneurship programs to encourage them to get into entrepreneurship programs. So we're not just working, you know, at the college level or at the after graduation level to match employers with interns. We're starting to now move into the high school level to generate interest among students in various careers and various business opportunities and entrepreneurship.
I want to ask you about the blue economy, because earlier, just a few days ago, we had a reporter for Forbes, Dale Buss, on our program, and he looked closely at how Michigan could be doing really a better job to harness water, its fresh water resources, really for economic and community growth. Have you given the blue economy much thought at Prima
Civitas? Absolutely,
we
have. It's a great question. And was part of our conversations that we had with some folks in Washington just the other day. There is great opportunity in this area for Michigan businesses and Michigan universities to have an impact worldwide on water technologies, the use of water, the conservation of water as economic development tools. I think it is probably I'm beginning to see it as the next big thing for Prima Civitas to work on with Michigan businesses and Michigan universities. In Wisconsin, for instance, they have put together a water council that sits in Milwaukee. It was started along with some major businesses, A.O. Smith, you know, the largest water heater maker in the country, Kohler, we all know for their plumbing, and some others who see great opportunities themselves. And I think that there's opportunity here for Michigan businesses and collaboration throughout the Great Lakes.
And any plans to annex the Crimea? Under
No.
No, okay, we'll leave that alone. You. Arnold Weinfeld is the incoming CEO of Prima Civitas, based here in East Lansing. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate it.
Current State on WKAR. Later this year, we mark the 100th anniversary of the extinction of the passenger pigeon, the last one being a resident of a Cincinnati zoo. That well-publicized event capped the annihilation of a species whose population was at one point so overwhelming that one ornithologist believed there were more passenger pigeons than all other species of birds combined. Efforts to bring the population under control began back in the mid-19th century, in part because enormous flocks wreaked havoc on trees and farms. Passenger pigeons were a common sight in Michigan in those years. Ann Arbor writer, author, and birder Bill Loomis recently wrote about the extraordinary Michigan history of the passenger pigeon for the Detroit News. He joins me now. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Mark. How you doing?
Real well. It's nice to have you along here today.
Oh, thanks.
To understand how many passenger pigeons there were in Michigan and the United States in the 19th century, it can be difficult to understand because the populations were mind-boggling, but some of the accounts in your story are so compelling. Can you share a couple of those?
Well, it was estimated that 4 out of 5 birds in the United States were passenger pigeons. I mean, they were in the billions, and they flew in these gigantic flocks. It's almost incomprehensible throughout the United States, all the way from the Hudson Bay up north down to Texas, and they covered they moved to Michigan in the 19th century as they were being as they lost habitat and they moved from the eastern side of the U.S. toward Michigan.
I see ornithologist Alexander Wilson claimed to have seen a flock of passenger pigeons a mile wide and 240 miles long. That is unfathomable. This meant he and others observed this torrent of birds for hours and hours?
Yeah, the birds would fly they'd fly about 60 miles an hour. They were very swift.
Okay.
So he noticed that the birds flew overhead for about 4 hours. He estimated that one flock to have 2,200,000,000 birds in it, and he said that's a very, very low number, he thought.
Mm. Environmentally, though, these enormous flocks created a lot of mayhem, at least locally.
Yeah,
and eventually agriculture and the passenger pigeon began to collide. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there were a number of forces that spelled the end for the pigeons. But basically, the pigeons came through the woods almost like a locomotive, and huge swaths of forest were eating all of the what they used to call mast, all the fruits of the forest, but they just the sheer numbers of them broke trees off, and their dung was sometimes a foot thick in some areas. The area up in Michigan, northern Michigan, called the Pigeon River, is named after the pigeons, and that was a roosting area. They roosted together. In other words, they gathered together at night for protection, and it was completely destroyed sometimes by these birds.
Looking at this issue through 21st century eyes, it's a tragedy because in 1914 it ended in extinction. As the birds' numbers plummeted, Bill, was there any concern about extinction?
Oh, there was a lot of concern. It was just a tragedy. If you read the Detroit News or Detroit Free Press editorials at the time, it was considered just a terrible waste. I think that there was a lot of concern, but there was very little they could do about it. What was conspiring was a combination of a big market for the birds. In other words, a commercial market had evolved. And so there were a lot of people making money off the birds. That combined with the railroads, they could get to spots quickly. And
was that primarily as a dish in restaurants? I know it was a popular food or cuisine. Yeah.
Yeah, it was popular in restaurants. James Audubon, the famous ornithologist, saw barges in the New York rivers outside of Manhattan. He thought they were filled with coal, but they actually mountains of pigeons that had been that were getting ready for the restaurants. But in addition, there was a new market in the South. The slaves were being fed pigeons, and so that was also a big source of money for the professional pigeoners called the pigeoners. And they would fly in, or they would come in to a town and just follow the flock and completely just keep hammering at it.
Do scientists understand how the population of the passenger pigeon became so colossal?
You know, there's no real... I looked into that pretty thoroughly, and there was no real one reason why these flocks had grown to such huge numbers. There was a feeling that they weren't always that big, but there was no one thing that they saw that caused it. There were, as the flocks would fly from location to location, they were tracked by hawks and eagles and things like that. So they did have predators, but just not enough.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. There is a plan, amazingly, to try to bring back the passenger pigeon through biotechnology, through the DNA, the genome of the bird, which, by the way, would not be the first time that this has happened. What do you make of that?
You know, it's an interesting experiment, but these numbers of these birds, they lived, really, they were found to be so gregarious, they had to have enormous numbers to continue. So I don't see how the bird could ever survive in any real healthy way without the sheer numbers of birds that they once had had. The birds that they'd had in captivity, the last bird, as you mentioned in your intro, was never very healthy, and it died. And even when they saw flocks of maybe 100 birds, they never lasted. They couldn't continue without the big numbers.
You are, not surprisingly, a birder, and you often view birds on the Detroit River. Are birds plentiful there? Are they more plentiful there than in the past?
Yeah, you know, Mark, they are. They have seen osprey on the Detroit Rivers, Detroit River for the first time since 1898. The numbers are growing. With the downturn in manufacturing, the upside is the river's coming back a bit. A lot, actually. In fact, this winter, people are seeing hundreds of bald eagles. And also, you know, the ducks group in what are called rafts on the water. And the biggest rafts I've seen have been 10,000 ducks. This year, with the ice clogging up a lot of the river, they're seeing rafts of 50,000 birds. So there's huge numbers of birds. But and standing and watching those birds, as they're flying by, it's so noisy with their quacking that it's hard to talk. So you can imagine what it must have been like to sit under a million or 100 million birds. Must have been really spectacular.
Getting back to the passenger pigeon, though, what was the larger popular attitude toward the bird? Did more people regard it as desirable, or did more people regard it as a nuisance?
You know, it changed over time as the birds were starting to diminish, and people could see this. Their attitude changed, but originally, you know, the way they treated the birds was similar to the way they thought about nature. Religion was a much stronger issue, and they saw man at the top of the hierarchy, men and women, and the animals beneath it, and the pigeons were a gift of God to people to do with what they will. And so that was one issue. Another thing was it was just greed, rapacious greed. People saw it as a way to make money. And initially, they would just hunt them for their own personal needs, or they'd sell them at the market for 10 cents a dozen. But once there was a market for pigeons, then all bets were off. So that brought around more problems. And then finally, the farming, as you mentioned, agriculture, as it grew, these birds could fly into a farm, and they would not only eat the fresh wheat, but they would tear out the roots. Mm-hmm. So a farmer in Niles, Michigan, reported in 1860 that he, within a matter of 2 hours, his entire planting, he was now standing in dust. There was not a single green thing left in the field.
Amazing. Bill, we got to leave it there. Bill Loomis lives in Ann Arbor and writes about Michigan history for the Detroit News, Michigan History Magazine, and more. He's the author of two books, Detroit's Delectable Past and a newer book, Detroit Food, released in January. Thank you, Bill Loomis.
Thanks, Mark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Back in the 1920s, ballrooms popped up across the United States, including in Detroit. The music that filled Detroit's dance halls was jazz. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Jim Gallert, a veteran jazz broadcaster, researcher, and writer. Together with Lars Bjorn, he wrote Before Motown, A History of Jazz in Detroit, 1920 to 1960. Emmanuel Berry joins us now. So what did you learn about Detroit's jazz history, Emmanuel?
Well, a lot. There is a bunch of material, and it's really way too much to try and squeeze into a single segment.
Yeah.
But if you're going to try and sort your way through all of this stuff in Detroit's jazz history, a good place to start is with Gene Goldkett.
And who is Gene Goldkett?
So Goldkett was a musical child prodigy. He trained in Moscow, but him and his mother, they relocated to Chicago, and he soon kind of realized that he would make more money if he was a dance pianist. So he started to work for Edgar Benson, who controlled many of the dance bands in Chicago and got kind of into the business side of things. Goldkett eventually ended up moving to Detroit, and as Jim Gallert explains, in 1922 he purchased the Greystone Ballroom.
The largest and most elegant of all the ballrooms in Detroit. There were about a dozen of them during the 1920s. So Goldkett was poised to become sort of the Edgar Benson of Detroit, if you will. And he controlled over a dozen bands at his height in the 1920s. So Goldkett was a very powerful guy, and his band, his main band, became one of the two most influential or noted Detroit bands in the 1920s.
The Greystone was segregated, as most ballrooms were at the time, but black bands did play there for white audiences, and one of the bands that Goldkett helped to build was McKinney's Cotton Pickers. And from the name, you would assume that they were raised in the Deep South or something, but that wasn't the case.
No, that was the way black entertainment was packaged for white audiences during the 20s and the 30s and the 1940s, and probably even a bit later. There was some connotation that would, in the name of the band or the name of the club that they performed at, to let you know it was either black-owned or that the band was an African-American band. And that's what the name McKinney's Cotton Pickers did for that particular band that was under the leadership of a guy named William McKinney, who was a businessman. He was a lot like Gene Goldkett in many ways. And Goldkett hired McKinney's band in the spring of 1927, brought them to Detroit, and in the fall of 1927, the band moved over to the Greystone from where they'd been playing. And Goldkett also got them a recording contract with Victor. And again, they had to go to Chicago, and where they made most of their recordings, and or to New York, where they made some. And like Goldkett's band, they had a distinctive sound that's difficult to describe in words.
Yeah, I want to. I have a clip actually from both of those bands, and I want to play them just to kind of get a sense of the variety that was there at the time. So up first, I have this is Gene Goldkett's orchestra. This is My Pretty Girl. Now I have for McKinney's Cotton Pickers, this is Will You, Won't You Be My Babe. It grooves.
It's a great track, and you notice you can hear the banjo in there, Dave Wilborn. Don Redman, who was the musical director, loved the sound of the banjo and the brass bass, and he was one of the last band leaders to abandon them in favor of a string bass and a guitar, and he uses them to great advantage there. I mean, the band has a really relaxed sound. It wasn't exactly what people would think of when they say, let's go get hot, man, play hot music, you know, with a real rapid-fire tempo, more like what Goldkett's band was playing. And the Cotton Pickers could definitely get hot and play hot music, but they could also play relaxed, more melodic-sounding music. So those are both great tracks by great bands.
The ballroom air eventually came to an end, and Goldkett even goes bankrupt. But after World War II, jazz kind of reemerges in Detroit. How does it reemerge different than that ballroom air jazz?
Well, by the 1940s and even by the late 1930s, Detroit had a great educational system. There were music courses taught in most of the high schools around Detroit. And there were some great musicians that that taught the students. So what we see in the late 30s and then in the 40s, we see now Detroit-trained musicians, guys who didn't come from elsewhere, like Ohio or New York or Chicago, but were actually born and raised in the city. And they could, you know, they had enough, they stayed long enough to take places in bands and work in Detroit bands around the city.
So they're not playing in these big ballrooms anymore. They're playing these small clubs in Paradise Valley and John R. Street a bit. I mean, what was that kind of atmosphere like for musicians?
Paradise Valley was the center of gravity for the African-American population in Detroit. It was a culture and business center. And that was where black folks played in clubs. You know, they owned a lot of the establishments. John R. Street emerged in the mid-1940s. It was dubbed the Street of Music. It was a whole string of clubs, about a dozen clubs, if not more, that ran up and down the length of John R. By the time John R. came up, the nature of the shows had shifted. The music that was presented, the entertainment that was presented in the clubs. Some of the clubs in Paradise Valley had floor shows. They would have a band to play for intermission and dancing, and then they would have a floor show and vocalists and things like that. And on John R., there were still some show bars, but a lot, there were more clubs where people would just go in and sit down and listen to the music.
There were a lot of musicians around this time, Thad and Elvin Jones, Terry Hollard, they're all playing in these areas. But a lot of them are kind of recruited away from the Motor City for a while, at least. What influence did Detroit musicians have in shaping the jazz world at large?
By the early 1950s, there was a sizable exodus of Detroit musicians who went on to Manhattan. It actually started before then. There were guys leaving by the mid-40s, but the 50s, though, which was really what Lars Bjorn, my friend and colleague Lars Bjorn, calls the golden age of Detroit jazz, because there were so many musicians that had all received a great musical education in the city, informal as well as formal, as well as through the high schools. And they started going to Manhattan in such numbers that some of the New Yorkers called it the Detroit invasion. There were so many Detroit musicians that went to New York City. As far as the influence of the musicians, what people would find, what New Yorkers found, was that all the Detroit musicians could read music very well. And they all had, they were all really good, too. So that they had and they all sounded distinctive. You know, they didn't sound the same like a whole mass of musicians that sound the very similar to one another. The trumpet players sounded different. I mean, all the Detroit musicians had developed their own sound, which is the hallmark of that's what a jazz soloist wants to be. A jazz musician wants to have his own sound or her own sound.
Many of those musicians who ended up staying in the city ended up working in Motown. You know, jazz kind of became overshadows isn't the right word. Maybe started to help shape R&B. What role did Detroit jazz play in developing Motown sound?
Well, the thing is that the Motown sound was really created by the musicians. It wasn't created by the vocal groups. If you watch the film Standing in the Shadows of Motown, you can hear, you recognize all the songs that the musicians play immediately. And it really, they're all performed, sung by different vocalists, different from the original recordings. But the band still sounds like, it still sounds like Motown, because the musicians were the same. Berry Gordy knew that the musicians could, because they were improvisers, they could create a sound, and they were never lost for ideas, whereas a regular studio musician might not have the grab bag of riffs or licks or notes that the jazz guys could grab onto and throw out in a second. So he took advantage of their creativity and their creative natures. One of the first records Berry Gordy released was a song called Come to Me by a vocalist named Marv Johnson, Marvelous Marv Johnson. And there's a brief flute solo in that song that's created by Beans Bowles. You know I miss you, baby. Just come on. that's one example of an improvised passage in a Motown record, but there were many others.
Where does jazz music in Detroit stand today?
There are problems with the school system. A lot of money, because of the dire straits in which Detroit finds itself, a lot of the educational programs have been severely cut. But the Detroit Jazz Festival steps up, and they send musicians into schools to conduct classes. So the ball is being picked up by others. WEMU, your sister public radio station in Ipsy, they help support jazz education. So does Vincent York's Jazzistry. And also, the thing is, the Detroit way in jazz is really musicians, older musicians, show the younger musicians how to do it, how to play. They help them. There's dozens of musicians that that teach on a private basis. And also, there's the best informal education you can get if you go to a club, and most clubs that feature jazz, and there are not too many now, but the ones which do offer jam session nights, where younger musicians can go and, you know, and sit in with a real, you know, a working jazz musician, a group of them, and learn. And that's a tradition that goes back to the 1920s. Musicians were always having jam sessions, you know, they were learning and sharing and trading ideas. And that's something that was never based on color. None of the music is based on color. It's all based on notes. And what kind of sound you get, and how much feeling you have in your notes. That's the whole thing.
Jim Gellert is a veteran jazz broadcaster, researcher, and writer. Together with Lars Bjorn, he wrote Before Motown, A History of Jazz in Detroit, 1920-60. Lars and Jim also run the website Detroit Music History. Jim, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, live music in Studio S from Red Tail Ring. We'll also hear from Susan Grettenberger, who plans to run against U.S. Congressman Mike Rogers. That and more Friday here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.